From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Finding the perfect mate to marry and then staying together is a daunting challenge that seems to be getting harder by the minute. Consider the facts. The median age for first marriages is now 25 for women and 27 for men, the oldest in American history. And 50% of those marriages will end in divorce. The number of unmarried couples living together has risen 1,000% since 1960. Still, from speed dating and the internet to the dreaded blind date, Americans never stop trying to beat the odds and find true love. But what if all the emphasis on romantic love and instant physical attraction is exactly what's holding us back, keeping us from finding the right mate, that true life partner? Is it possible that you can learn to love someone if you have some common interest and put your heart and mind into it? That's what tonight's guest, Robert Epstein, editor-in-chief of Psychology Today magazine, is determined to find out. And he's using himself as the guinea pig of cultivated passion. He wants to use science to help him find his perfect mate. Can real relationships and love be engineered is the question. And what does it say about our culture, our love lives, that we're trying? Do we need a new American way of mating? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Cardiff by the Sea, California, is Robert Epstein. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Epstein.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Robert Epstein, we're not entirely sure whether you're putting us on or serious here. What is your diagnosis of the problem in the American way of mating or in your personal way of mating that you're trying to address here?
Well, first of all, I am very serious. I'm also a psychology professor and I'm a pretty serious scientist and have been for several decades. So I think the problem I'm addressing
We grant that you've got a serious background, but I'm looking here at your love contract with a big heart on it and doopsy-doos in the corners. And we're just wondering, take us into your theory of the case here about why we need a new way.
Well, first of all, I think our quest for love and romance is guided mainly by two myths. First is the myth of the one or the soulmate. I think that's absolutely absurd, as common sense would tell you, besides the data. And the other myth is a very dangerous one. That's the myth of happily ever after, that says that, you know, even if things are good today, they're going to be okay forever. No one's ever going to get fat. No one's ever going to get old. No one's going to cheat. And it sends people into marriage with unrealistic expectations and also utterly without skills. And by the time we try to get those skills, maybe in counseling, it's often too late. We've hurt each other too much. So all I'm really saying here is, and just borrowing one aspect of arranged marriage, is that we can take the tools of the mental health profession, use those proactively instead of reactively, and right up front, right from the first kiss on, what I'm doing is I'm looking for someone who will commit to engaging in a process by which we're going to learn to know each other very intimately, learn to trust, learn to communicate, and ultimately to learn to love each other, just using mainly existing counseling techniques and a couple of new ones.
You write about your interest in arranged marriages, but we're not in Bombay or Delhi here. What exactly do you see and admire in arranged marriages, and what part of that do you think might be pulled into the American way of courtship?
Well, really just one aspect of it intrigues me tremendously. I've been interviewing many couples in arranged marriages, and it appears that in maybe half of arranged marriages, or at least in India, that people are brought together by a family, barely knowing each other. There usually is attraction, by the way. That's a myth we have here. In fact, in arranged marriages, usually people do get to check each other out. So there is some attraction, but they don't know each other very well. But over a period of time, some of these couples come to fall in love with each other, sometimes very, very deeply. And so, in other words, we know, the basic question I'm asking, we already know the answer to. We know people can learn to love. And so I'm saying, can we package that process for the Westerner, maybe using mental health techniques, and make it work for us?
Now, the mental health techniques you're talking about, you've distilled into something called the love contract. It's got a super Oprah sound to it here. but describe it for us. I'm looking at it. And by the way, listeners, you can see this if you go to our website at onpointradio.org. That's onpointradio.org. You can check it out. Robert Epstein's love contract. But this is something that would be signed at the outset of a kind of getting to know you period between two potential candidates for marriage, I guess. And describe to us what people commit to when they sign up for what you're prepared to commit to when you sign up for this engineered kind of courtship.
Sure. Well, it's pretty simple. It's physically supposed to look fairly beautiful, and the language of it is supposed to be very romantic. In other words, we're keeping the romance here. We're just a different.
It's all hearts and fleur-de-lis. We've got that.
Oh, yeah. Just a different approach to romance. And summarizing it very briefly, it starts by saying that we believe in love, because I don't think Americans are going to abandon that, and that we believe we can learn. So those are two important things. And then the next section states some goals that we are going to commit for a certain period of time, during which we don't date anyone else. We're going to commit to achieving some goals, like learning to communicate, putting aside old traumas that we might have so that we can feel love, learning to express our feelings, learning to trust each other, learning to forgive each other, and so on. And ultimately, learning to love each other very deeply with a love that is ever-growing. So that's kind of the commitment part of it. And then the next part is on activities. The couple checks off some activities that they're agreeing to engage in. For example, going to a counselor at least once a week.
A love therapist, no less.
A love therapist, right. And maybe going on some special retreats that promote love. Some of the top counselors in the United States have already agreed to serve as counselors for me and my partner-to-be, including John Gray, the Mars Venus guru, and some highly, highly skilled couples counselors who may not be known to the public but are extremely good. And that's pretty much it. I mean, you state some goals and you state some activities and say we're going to give this a fair shot, and you agree to the time period you're going to do this for. I'm thinking maybe 6 months is probably adequate. And at the end of this, the question is, out of 100 couples, how many will actually have achieved these lofty, lovely, beautiful goals? And I can't tell you that number, but I do know for sure that this is going to work for a certain number of couples, maybe 40 out of 100. I don't know.
So we got it. So it's the love contract. You can read it, listeners, at you can get to it at onpointradio.org. But essentially it's saying we're going to get to know each other, we're going to be humane, and we're going to be deliberate in getting to know each other. Isn't that, Robert Epstein, what we ought to expect from people in any case?
Well, yeah, but the reality is that what people really do is date. And as I've said in the editorial, the new editorial in Psychology Today, which I've just sent off to the printer, in dating, we're mainly after plumage, not probity, by which I mean that we really deceive each other in dating. In fact, that's really part of the institution of dating, is you put on your best clothes and your best manner and your best foot forward and your best of everything. Mm. And it's very easy, having dated someone for a long time and maybe then even have gotten engaged or married, it's very easy to look at someone one day and say, "Who are you? I don't know you at all." And I've been through that, and I think a lot of people have. And engaging in this process that I'm outlining, that will not happen. You'll be starting out right at the beginning with professional assistance to make sure that you know each other very deeply and that you develop good relationship skills.
Listeners, we're talking with Robert Epstein. He's editor-in-chief of Psychology Today magazine. He's making himself a kind of guinea pig for love here. He's ready to sign the love contract with whoever's prepared to get into a really serious effort to get to know him and to really investigate whether this might be a good match. At one level, this is pure American pop commercialism. It's made for Oprah, and there will be a book written out of it, and maybe, Robert Epstein, you'll do a TV show as well. At another level, maybe this is something that Americans are really struggling with, and maybe there's something to it. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. talk, Jack Beatty? Is this speaking to you?
Well, if Dr. Epstein is right, then all of Western literature, starting from the Greeks and Tristan and Isolde, and the Romantic poets and Ford Madox Ford, they're all wrong. Love is not this all-engulfing, near-psychotic, as Freud called it, overestimation of the other. It's not the thing that leads people to sacrifice their lives. It's not the mad passion that we see. No, it's a little bit like a tea party. You know, he wants to perform a prefrontal lobotomy on love, on the most powerful and really definingly human essence. And it's ludicrous. And, well, I mean, good luck to him. I mean, we achieved in the 20th century the modernization of sex, you know, took the romance out of it. he's gonna try to take the romance out of love and courtship. And, I mean, we may be heading that way, but God help us if we are.
But, Jack, he's saying just the opposite, that he doesn't want a lobotomy here. He wants to make it a more rational, more thoughtful process.
Right. The idea that you can make it rational and thoughtful. Good luck to you.
Well, but no, it's really just taking the insanity out of it. The romance and the passion and all that will be there even more than ever before. But it's the insanity part, which you just referred to. That's what's dangerous.
Right,
what's killing us.
But that's exactly what we've celebrated for centuries in Western tradition. Isn't it, Robert Epstein? Isn't that kind of what we've been taught to long for by poets and writers and singers for millennia?
Taught to long for, taught to revile. You know, love stinks. I mean, that's what the song says. So it depends how you look at it. But I'm looking at the ravages that we leave in love's wake. The millions of kids in this country who are being raised in broken homes, and the devastation that's wrought upon our society. And I'm positive that we can do this in a better way. But I'm not saying that we abandon anything except the insane part. The rest of it is beautiful, and I want to keep it, make it better.
Listeners, should we abandon the insane part of love in order to make better matches? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Robert Epstein, stand by. We're joined now by Pepper Schwartz. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Washington. Good evening and welcome, Pepper Schwartz.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thanks for being with us. You have thought a lot about relationships and love. You've written The Great Sex Weekend, and everything you know about love and sex is wrong. You must have seen Robert Epstein, the campaign that he's mounting here. What do you think of this? Can we bring an element of arranged marriage into American mating and courtship?
Well, it is a hybrid for sure, and in a sense, I think it may be neither nor. The essential element of arranged marriage is you get matched on structural characteristics like class, caste, income. It's about keeping your social status, period. And, you know, you get a little chance to like each other, but it's not about love, and nobody pretends it's about love. They say maybe we'll learn to love. And some do. It's the luck of the draw, and some don't. But the essential characteristic of real arranged marriage is you can never get divorced.
But what about the element that Robert Epstein picks up on, which is that very often these people do learn to love, or at least live together in a warm relationship, perhaps even more successfully than Americans do?
Well, they don't. I mean, the research shows they don't. There's a lot of stuff by Hatfield and, I'm forgetting the second author now, Sprecher, where they did a lot of cross-cultural research on arranged marriages versus love matches. And the fact is that the majority of them are not in love. They are, of course, stable. They do have companionate rewards for each other. They fit for the society, but they're not in love. I mean, a small percentage of them are. So the idea that you can, in fact, at least just put people together by those structural characteristics doesn't match our Western idea of love, although, you know, it may put together a perfectly well-functioning couple who likes each other very much, and some will, in fact, by chance, love each other. If that's what we want, we can do that, but I don't think we're, you know, on that road. The other thing that Mr. Epstein's doing, which is kind of a psychology-soaked dating, that is, okay, we're gonna put together some characteristics here that would normally be, you know, desirable, which is what you do in dating, and then we're just going to go through every process psychologists have ever thought out, know each other backwards and forwards, and then see if we can move on.
Pepper Schwartz, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about making love happen, about looking for new American mating rituals. We're joined by Pepper Schwartz. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Washington, and by Robert Epstein. He's editor-in-chief of Psychology Today magazine, and he has announced to the world that he's embarking on what he calls a bold, very personal experiment, one that some might call, and our news analyst Jack Beattie has practically, might call crazy. But he says, our way of mating is all wrong. We're all caught up in myths. We teach our children, and especially our little girls, that a knight in shining Porsche is going to drive up one day, awaken perfect passion, a magical kiss, and then drive the blessed couple down the road to happily ever after. No, he says, better to work on it very deliberately, better to engineer it, to make love happen through rational effort. And he's looking for a woman to do that with him. What do you think? Does the American way of mating work? Should we stop looking for love and make it happen instead? Or is magic, is sudden lightning, the essence of love? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beattie, we're making the love connection tonight. Kiss me, you fool. But we're trying here. Robert Epstein, what kind of response have you had so far to your offer to step up, read this contract, sign it, and make this effort with you?
Well, there are two kinds of responses, both of which are absolutely surprising to me. First of all, I've never solicited applications from anybody anywhere. I just wrote about the concept in my editorial and then kind of put out the word through friends and family that I was looking for this very special partner. I have been completely inundated. I've had letters, photos, phone calls from all over the world from women wanting to do this with me or hoping that it works if I don't pick them, and that's important here.
Hoping that really it works if you – what does that mean? Hoping it works if you don't pick them?
No, even if you don't pick me, I really hope this works.
Oh, I see.
Because it will change my life. It will help me lead my life differently.
They'd like to see a better way of finding and growing close to a partner.
Oh, yeah. And then a media frenzy arose from nowhere. I have no idea why it's happening. I've been doing 4 or 5 interviews a day for weeks. There have been newspaper. Yeah, and I've turned down national television interviews from Dateline, 2020, Primetime, Good Morning America, Today Show, you name it. I've turned them all down.
But you are looking to start a reality TV show out of this.
I'm not looking to do that. I mean, that is just happening.
But if your arm was twisted, you'd be open to having your first kiss videotaped.
I'm very uncertain about that. If there's a TV show, I think I'd want to just be maybe an on-air expert or a consultant. What people are asking me to do, that's a different story. Yes, we've probably had, I think, 16 or 17 different television production companies calling saying they want to do a documentary on this. And
we could give you a hard time about that all night, but it is intriguing what you're working with at the heart of it here, this idea of deliberately setting out to forge a love. Pepper Schwartz, even without an explicit solicitation, Robert Epstein says he's had hundreds of women who want to sign this contract with him. What do you make of that in itself?
Well, not to be cynical, but he is the editor-in-chief of a major magazine. I mean, women are attracted to that kind of accomplishment, and also to the idea that someone is going to be very seriously considering them as a partner.
But they've never met him. They've never even seen him from a distance.
They have a fantasy of him, which is often what relationships start as, a fantasy of what he must be like. And, of course, maybe, I don't even know if they've read his work, but they can, we have people having fan clubs, love affairs with actors, with people they haven't and never will meet. The fact is that women are romantic. The idea of the adventure, maybe the publicity, and certainly the status of the guy is not, is absolutely guaranteed to get this kind of response. I think somewhat more interesting, and I think he brought it up himself, is the idea that there is some longing to figure out some way that it's not all just chaos in terms of who you end up with. Mm-hmm. And so there is some sense of, well, maybe this is a pattern that might help. We could only date seriously, and we would go through a lot of things to help us in our process.
And in some sense,
the conservative church, by the way, has something they call courtship, which is not unlike this.
Where people deliberately set out to get to know each other with a kind of upfront commitment to working hard at it.
Well, in their case, it's almost like an arranged marriage, but it has the same structure.
I guess, in some sense, this isn't such a leap from what I know of dating services and clubs. People fill out huge forms before they put their name into those hats. So this is, must be, in some dimensions, very familiar to some people. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Can Americans make love happen? Linda is on the line. Welcome, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, good to have you.
I just want to say, I think this is a Robert Epstein's idea is a great idea. I'm not quite sure I understand it, however. At first I thought that, Robert, you were going to do this experience with someone that you already knew, and I understood that that's what this idea was about. I'm a divorced woman, I'm 47 years old, and I have just very recently joined a dating service online. And
is it working for you, Linda?
Well, I don't know, because I just did it a couple of days ago, so I haven't really done anything yet.
But what do you think of the idea of making an upfront commitment with someone to put in 6 months to really working on trying to create a relationship, even if there wasn't magic at the bar?
Someone that to create a relationship leading to marriage?
Well, I guess that's the ultimate goal.
I'm not so sure I'd want to create a relationship. I'm not so sure that I would make a commitment leading to marriage, but I would absolutely make a commitment to exclusivity for 6 months to so that I wouldn't make the mistakes that I made the last time.
As a divorced woman, you know, how have you found the scene out there so far trying to find a new relationship?
I haven't made the time. I haven't made the time to find a new relationship.
Yeah. I guess it's hard to make the time. It's a big effort. Linda, thank you for your call. Robert Epstein, you can hear Linda gearing up.
Yeah.
To jump back into this whole scene, it is a famously difficult process.
Well, Linda, let me tell you, it's a jungle out there, and you know, this is not a commitment of marriage. It's a very different kind of commitment, and you agree on the time period with your partner, and it could very well be someone you know. In fact, I've had a lot of cameramen over at my house recently. They've been walking off with these love contracts because they wanted to, quote-unquote, have a discussion with their girlfriends. So it could be someone you've been dating, could be someone you know from work, could be a neighbor, and maybe you do feel that wonderful spark, but maybe nothing has happened. And all I'm saying is now you commit to exclusivity and to engaging in a process for a certain number of months, and I know this will be very successful. And by the way, Dr. Schwartz has, and I apparently are reading different scientific literature, because arranged marriage works extremely well, even in cultures where divorce is allowed. And in India, according to one study, possibly half of the couples in India actually end up feeling some sort of love toward each other, in some cases a very deep love. But even if it were 5% or 10%, it tells us that this can be done, and I know this is going to be extremely successful, not for everybody, but for a lot of people.
One of the things that a signator to your love contract agrees to do is to participate in games and exercises designed to promote our mutual love. What does that mean?
Well, there are exercises that are used by some retreats or they're used by some counselors that are really wonderful in promoting strong feelings and getting people to bond. One of the simplest ones is a breathing exercise, believe it or not. I'm not saying you can base a whole relationship on this, by the way, but you simply hold the person. This will work with a total stranger. If there's a stranger nearby you and you want to try this, I mean, it's very powerful.
Listeners, reach out now.
Reach out now to a stranger and just hold that person and listen to the person's breathing and synchronize your breathing. It's something that simple, just synchronizing your breathing with another person for a few minutes, produces a very powerful experience of closeness, of bonding. And there, the point is there are many, many exercises like this, some very simple or maybe simplistic and others very complex, that allow you to know a person and become very sensitive to their needs. And I'm saying you can go about that deliberately with somebody.
Jack Beatty, we heard you stand up for raging romantic love earlier, but you've got to be sympathetic to some degree to people who say, gosh, it's hard the way society is structured today to get into a circumstance where that happens. At least will you give Robert Epstein credit here for trying to create the possibility?
Well, I mean, it's a tragic situation, isn't it? I mean, and it's been that way from time immemorial. And rationalists from time immemorial have said, boy, this is a crazy thing. If only we could get this down to management science, people would be so much happier. Where is Anthony Burgess? I mean, if he heard this, he'd go and rewrite Clockwork Orange. It's great to take the human out of human beings, but what's left isn't all that interesting. You know, Dr. Epstein's got it figured out. Here he is. He's a middle-aged guy. And one of the people he's thinking of starting this off with is a woman in her 20s. And, he admires her, he writes, for her, quote, intelligence, end quote, and, quote, writing skills, end quote. And, you know, he uses the he gets the young woman with the prospect of the book contract and gets the contract with the prospect of the young woman.
Now, I don't want to
she
get you guys in
the deal.
I don't want to get you guys in a fist fight here, Jack. You may be impugning a genuine.
I mean, this is a stunt. This is a money making proposition, and it's not about love. It's about commerce.
Well, Jack, we've got a real skeptic here, Robert
respect,
Epstein.
Jack, excuse me, Jack, but with all due respect, you don't know me from Adam. And my most recent serious relationship was with a woman in her 40s. I've only met 5 people in this whole process because I don't have time. I haven't had time to do more. But the one I met most recently is 44 years old. So that's just absurd. My interest in this is totally sincere. My heart is in it. I know it will work, and I know it will help a lot of people.
Mm. Robert Epstein, Pepper Schwartz, come in.
Yeah, I mean, there is such thing as self-fulfilling prophecy. If he knows it will work, it'll work. But I have a couple of questions. First of all, this is a very intense 6 months. It is not a 6 months like other 6 months, obviously. Mm-hmm. So at the end of that, you know, where's the reality base? I mean, some of the things he mentions, like the breathing exercise, comes out of the tantric tradition. They're very bonding, very emotional kinds of things. I don't doubt they start to bring people together. But the question is, do you create a world that can possibly compare to the next 6 months after it? What happens at the end of 6 months? What kind of commitment have you made? Even if you're wildly in love, which would be a nice outcome, nobody's against it, Is it based on something that has any relationship to what follows?
Pepper, we'll put that to Robert Epstein, but let me ask you first, wouldn't any potential long-term relationship benefit by 6 months of intensive attention?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't have anything against that. If we're doing it like summer camp, you know, which is to say, you know, an activity every 2 hours or in a way that doesn't, you know, relate to, you know, the school year. I think it may be misleading rather than selective. But do I think couples should talk and find ways to get to know each other deeply and make a commitment if that's what they're at? You know, and I mean, I see this even in online dating where people say, hey, I'm serious now. I'm looking for someone serious. And they're trying to select out people who aren't willing to work in a relationship. So I don't see it that much different. I think that with, you know, this is sort of like dating with, you know, deep psychological pockets. And I don't mind that at all. I just think, A, that it's going to be somewhat artificial. B, that it is an interesting idea that you can pick someone and say, now I'm going to be serious, because usually that's what people are. They are serious, and they go through a series of serious relationships that don't quite culminate. So I want to know what the trigger is that makes this different so it culminates at some place. Do you just at 6 months say, okay, we're doing really well, we get married, or what do you do?
Well, let's ask Robert Epstein, are you setting up a kind of artifice, a kind of summer camp that won't have lasting foundations or something better than that?
Well, it's a little too early to tell, of course, but you think of the alternatives. The alternatives right now are are dating, in which there's an enormous amount of uncertainty, very little real intimate knowledge, grows in the process of normal dating. It's very easy to be deceived. In fact, that's what dating is all about. It's all about deception. So that's the alternative. And then the alternative is that you go through things the way we go through them now, and maybe you get married or you live together or whatever it is, and then down the road you find your relationship is failing, and then you go through this process. Mm-hmm. That's absurd.
So you're saying let's do it up front.
Well, let's take a proactive approach to love and romance instead of a reactive approach. Same thing that's happening in medicine, where instead of just focusing on disease exclusively, mm-hmm. which is what we do in mental health, mm-hmm. let's start focusing up front on wellness or well-being. Let's do it right at the very beginning, right from the first kiss. I think it's very romantic.
Get the therapy first. Justin is on the line. Welcome, Justin. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. How are you this
evening? Fine, thanks. Fine.
My point is, I think Americans or our society were in love with the idea of an ideal mate.
Is something wrong with that?
Well, I think it does get in the way of our learning to understand the person we're with sometimes. And that's just on the way in, actually.
So you're saying let's move away from the search for the ideal and get real.
Exactly. I think Mr. Epstein had a very good point. You can learn to love someone. And I think this concentration on bonding, on communication, these are very vital survival tools for a relationship. And getting to know someone intimately will help you understand that person, communicate with them, and love them. I do think it would be a dangerous thing to fall in love with someone who you had a lot of differences, maybe a lifestyle or core beliefs. But I do think you could learn to love somebody.
Justin, there's a vote for it, and thank you for your call. Let's get one more before the break. Karen's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for calling. How are you?
Sure. Good.
I had a couple of thoughts. I'm in my early 50s and divorced, so I grew up in the free and easy 60s and 70s, and you mentioned earlier the modernization of sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this idea has some merit in that if we committed to getting to know one another, I think what happens so often is that sex can get in the way of people truly getting to know each other, rather than holding that out as something really special. It becomes just part of the mundane, and I think it can sometimes get in the way of people getting to know one another.
Well, raise one of the core issues, Karen. Let me put that to Robert Epstein before the break. How does sex figure into your love contract period, Robert Epstein? Does it include, exclude?
I'm so glad that the issue was raised, because I forgot to mention it earlier. One of the things that's essential in this love contract is that you commit to learning to distinguish lust from love. So whether or not you decide to have sex, to me, that's up to the individuals always. But what's critical is that you learn to make that distinction, because right now in our society, we get them very confused. You can learn to distinguish them, and we become so overwhelmed with lust that we end up ultimately with nothing, because the passion fades, and then what have you got?
What do you think personally? Do you think that a sexual relationship during this period of getting to know one another is important or not to have?
Again, I think it's up to the individuals, and when I find a partner who has the wherewithal to sign this thing with me, I would hope that we just work that out together, and I would certainly hope that I would not be overwhelmed by sex. I think sex is beautiful and wonderful, but in the past I've certainly had that happen where sex just dominates the relationship for the first few months or the first few years, and then ultimately, there's someone left there behind. There's someone left there, and that's the fog clears, and you say, I don't want to be with this person, and I don't want to be in that position ever.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking about making love happen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about making love happen, about looking for new mating rituals in America. Our guests tonight are Pepper Schwartz. She's professor of sociology at the University of Washington. And Robert Epstein, he's editor-in-chief of Psychology Today magazine. He is saying, don't wait for the lightning of love to strike. Go out and arrange a relationship for you. Engineer yourself some love. We've got a lot of callers who want to join and not much time. Let's get right to them. Aminashi is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome, Aminashi. You're on the air.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I just wanted to share, I'm from India, but now I live in Madison.
Okay.
And I just wanted to share a viewpoint that my husband and I had a arranged marriage last year. And I came down from India, and actually our parents worked everything out. Like, they saw our horoscopes, and I saw my husband's picture, and we spoke over the phone and just exchanged a few emails.
How long before your marriage did you meet, Aminashi?
We didn't meet because we just met 3 days before the wedding.
Wow. So how's it going?
It's great. And I have to just tell you one thing, that it's not, it's just what has happened with me. It may not be true with everybody, but I guess marriages and relationships work once you feel in your mind that it would work.
So do you think you're making love happen in the months since your marriage?
Yeah, because actually what happened was, like, after we liked each other, our parents went ahead with the relationship and we had an engagement and we got married within 2 days, and I came to Madison and I left my whole country. So it was a big step for me, but I feel that, I don't know, I feel I really had a confidence that it would work out, and it's really going great. My husband and I have a lot of things in common. There are certain things which we don't agree, but I guess that's a part of life. You can never find anybody who's going to have a perfect, you know, match for yours.
Yeah, but there's a vote for the arranged approach. And Aminashi, thanks so much for sharing that with us. I want to get to Nancy. Nancy, welcome. You're on the air.
Can I mention a quick statistics here? In India, 95% of the marriages are arranged. Divorce is legal, and it has a divorce rate under 1%. And one recent survey done of business people in at least in urban India showed that 94% of those people responding said they were very satisfied with their marriage.
I don't want to go back into those statistics with the little time we have left, Robert Epstein. I'm sure they can be debated. But let's talk to people who want to talk to us. Nancy's on the air. Welcome, Nancy. You're on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to mention two things. One, just quickly, anybody interested in this subject should really take a look at Emanuel Swedenborg's writings on conjugal love and scortatory love.
Okay.
And then from a personal point of view, I found it interesting the way they keep talking about dating and deception, and this game of deception. And I wanted to mention that I totally believe and have experienced that you can meet a person that you cannot play the deception game with, that two people can meet each other and have this profound experience of not being able to hide anything from each other and discovering at a very deep level a similarity that is so intense, and that I think that that would be the basis.
And so genuine. But can you make that happen if you don't just run into it?
I don't believe you can make... I think the only way that you can make that happen is by, A, wanting it very badly, and B, getting to know yourself in the good old-fashioned philosophical way of knowing yourself.
We got it. Nancy, thank you for your call. Pepper Schwartz, step back with us for a second here. You can hear in the voices, and I'm sure you hear it often, it is not easy to do this. Americans are looking for something, and many people say we need a better way. What makes it difficult today, or has it always been difficult, this difficult, to find that right companion?
I think the thing that makes it, well, there's two things that make it difficult, maybe three. But the most important one is our high expectations of what we need to fall in love with. I mean, it went from, you know, someone who wouldn't beat us or who wouldn't drink, to somebody who was a good provider and a good mother, to somebody, you know, who had respect for us and was companionate. And now we want, you know, I bet if I said fill in the blank, what does everybody want now, you'd know the word. And it's soulmate. Everybody wants a soulmate. Well, that's a whole lot harder to achieve than before. And, of course, we've taken the stigma away of breaking up relationships, and that has its good points and its bad points. But in general, when we don't get a soulmate, this extremely high demanding romantic concept, we feel unfulfilled.
Our time is running out, Pepper Schwartz, but thanks for that, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure.
Pepper Schwartz is professor of sociology at the University of Washington. Robert Brustein, just 20 seconds left. We've given you a hard time, but we admire you for trying. Do you think you'll come out of this with a soulmate?
I really hope not, because I think that is a silly myth, and I think it causes untold pain for people, and ultimately for children of broken marriages. I'm not looking for a soulmate. I think we need to abandon that myth and just find a better way to get romance and love.
There it is. Robert Epstein, thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Robert Epstein is editor-in-chief of Psychology Today magazine. Jack Beatty, no soulmate for Robert Epstein.
Well, good luck with him. All I can do is end with Robert Browning. Come grow old with me. The best is yet to be.
I'm already engaged, Jack. Continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, On Point's movie maven charts the search for the perfect spouse on the big screen. This is On Point. Stories of the search for the perfect spouse are nothing new. They go back at least as far as Greek mythology and the story of Pygmalion, the sculptor who falls in love with his statue. His desire leads him to ask the gods to bring her to life, which they do, and they marry and live happily ever after. George Bernard Shaw adapted the Pygmalion story for the stage and Hollywood into the popular movie My Fair Lady.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
Again.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
I think she's got it.
There have been countless big screen renditions of the struggle of men and women to find and shape the perfect spouse. Here to share a few of the best is our On Point movie maven, Garen Daly. Welcome, Garen.
Hi, Tom.
So, Pygmalion, Hollywood can't get over it, can't get enough of it, the makeover story.
It is the makeover story, and it's not only makeover story, it's the creation. I mean, look back to the 30s, you've got not only Pygmalion, which was, you know, George Bernard Shaw's Oscar winner, but you got Bride of Frankenstein from James Whale. I mean, Hollywood has always been a little enticed by this, trying to create the perfect woman or create the perfect man.
Well, they would be, wouldn't they? I mean, that's what Hollywood does for a living.
It is. It's all fantasy. It is all creation. And, you know, one of the finest films to come out in the past decade or so was Pretty Woman, which shows almost all of Hollywood's indications or predilections towards creating these kind of women. It's clearly an anti-feminist film because it's all about a princess being rescued.
When I was a little girl, my mama used to lock me in the attic when I was bad, which was pretty often. And I would pretend I was a princess trapped in the tower by a wicked queen. And then suddenly, this knight on a white horse with these colors flying would come charging up and draw his sword. And I would wave, and he would climb up the tower and rescue me. But never, and all the time, that I had this dream, did the knight say to me, "Come on, baby, I'll put you up in a great condo."
Pretty Woman, a princess being rescued, but the princess is a prostitute, and what a popular movie.
It is. It's an amazingly popular film. And again, if you start deconstructing this film, you start realizing that, you know, she is falling into that classic category of the Madonna and the whore, and that Richard Gere is someone who is emotionally constrained and needs someone from the streets, from the lower strata, to come up and open him up. But in the process, he has to teach her how to dress, how to eat, and how to be good in society. And in that process, he ends up falling in love with his creation to the point where he satisfies her need, at the end, to be rescued by a knight.
Is there a guy version of the gal makeover?
There's several of them. One of the ones that I saw back in, 1987 was a film by Susan Seidelman. Susan Seidelman directed Desperately Seeking Susan. Mm. She also has been directing Sex and the City and Now and Again on TV. She's a very good director, and she made a film called Making Mr. Right. In this film, John Malkovich plays a dual character. He plays a scientist named by the name of Dr. Jeff Peters, who creates an android who is going to be sent into space for long journeys, 7-8 years journey. So they can't send a human, so they create this android. Android's name is Ulysses, obviously.
But of course.
But they need to get funding. They need to make it more accessible, so they hire a public relations person to make the android more human. And in that process, there comes the conflict between the scientist looking to quantify his life and then the emotional side, which is being developed by the publicist inside the android.
Oh, my God! What is that woman teaching you? She is cluttering his progress with useless nonsense, monopolizing very valuable training time with God knows what. Emotional tics that I have worked to get out of my own personality, she has managed to drum into him overnight. This morning, Ulysses met me in that hall, and he kissed me right near my mouth.
I guess he likes you, Jeff.
the android more human than maker kissing right near the mouth.
Right near the mouth, yeah. And that's exactly what happens. The scientist is becoming less human, and the android is becoming more human, more emotional.
You've got a film about computer geeks who make the perfect woman, who then in turn goes into a nerds to men routine for them.
Oh, yeah, Weird Science, and which I think is one of those wonderful little cult films that is a guilty pleasure for a lot of guys to watch. John Hughes directs this film. It's 1985. Anthony Michael Hall is in it. And what it is these two totally wasted guys and nerds, they have absolutely no social life, create a wonderful, gorgeous woman played by Kelly LeBrock, and they're just all of a sudden, because they have this beautiful woman, they're accepted in their high school, and then she slowly starts teaching them how to do things. But when they start off, they don't really know what they're doing. They've just watched Bride of Frankenstein, and they say to themselves, you know, we might be able to do this.
You know, it's not a bad idea.
What?
Making a girl. Just like Frankenstein, except cuter. You know how you're always talking about how you can simulate all that stuff on your computer? You know? What's the difference? Why can't we simulate a girl?
I don't know. I guess I could, but why? It's two-dimensional on the screen. It's not flesh and blood, Gary.
Well, I know that, but, you know, we can use it. Why? We can ask it questions. We can put it in real-life sexual situations and see how it reacts.
Love it.
Weird Science, where the story goes both ways, where the boys make the dream woman makes men of boys.
That's right. That's exactly what this is all about. These guys are such social outcasts, they needed to find courage and confidence by creating the perfect woman. And in the process, they end up creating this woman. They have a whole series of adventures, but she teaches them. It is not the perfection of a simply gorgeous model woman. It is the love that they find with two young teenage girls with themselves that really makes them men. And it continues. Even the teen comedies. I mean, you know, there's a plethora of teen comedies that are coming out all the time. Some of these are not very good. One that is an okay one, but it still has those same themes, is She's All That, 1999, Freddie Prinze Jr. and Rachel Lee Cook. And again, it takes place in a high school, but this time it's not the lower strata, the social outcast nerds. It's the top dogs, the big man on campus. The guys that are so overconfident, that are trying to figure out, you know, what is the perfect person, who is the perfect girl, who is the perfect date, who is the perfect prom queen. And in this film, Freddie Prinze Jr. gets dumped by his girlfriend, and it becomes an issue with his buddies.
Take her, for example. Short, decent rack, kind of a Chelsea Clinton thing going on. But given the right look, the right boyfriend, bam, in 6 weeks, she's the one being crowned prom queen.
You're serious?
That's a heart attack.
Yeah, clearly delusional. But how about a chance to prove me wrong?
A bet?
Yeah.
Name the terms.
All right, simple. I'll pick the girl. And you got 6 weeks to turn her into the prom queen.
You got it.
Garen Daly, with computer-generated action figures and digital actors, virtual reality, it looks like we're headed into a time where the Pygmalion story can be repeated and enhanced again and again. We can make anything now.
Well, it's true. I mean, since Metropolis all the way up to She's All That, and even something that's coming out in a couple of weeks called Simone, which is the new Al Pacino film, which is exactly the same story. And in this film, Al Pacino is a director who loses his leading lady, and so he creates another one digitally, and she becomes a major, major star. Just like Laura Croft in the Tomb Raider series has become a major star, and Anna Nova, that newscaster from England, we are approaching the time when virtual stars are going to become our Pygmalions, and we can do anything we want with them. It still goes back to George Bernard Shaw. By the way, my trivia question for you.
Okay.
All right, what is George Bernard Shaw's real claim to fame with Hollywood?
Buck and Wing.
Okay, he's the only person ever to win an Oscar for the screenplay of Pygmalion and a Nobel Prize.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, George Bernard Shaw and Garen Daly, our movie critic, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. Garen Daly, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Tim Skog, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Chris Bonacci and Sabi Mir. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The only one for me is you, and you for me. So happy together.
This is WBUR. We're